Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Rahul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Rahul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, E-L-A-W-V-A-T-E.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net. And Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Gross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer. And you always want to keep up. And the best way to do that is with Expert Institute. Welcome to the Elevate podcast. I'm Rahul Ravapudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, I feel like we're constantly opening these podcast episodes by talking about some major catastrophe going on in Los Angeles, but we now have the protests going on there and National Guard and Marines coming to town. So give us the lay of the land. What's going on there?
I think this is partly one of those things where, you know, the media makes it look worse than it really is. There's a certain part where there's public and peaceful protests happening. And then what seems to be the trend these days, no matter which state you're in, is there's some wrongdoers who want to make a peaceful event a whole lot less peaceful. Now, this is me speaking personally. I don't think we need the Marines here. I don't think we needed the National Guard here. And I think this public spectacle and making an example of California is par for the course with our current president.
You think there might be some politics involved, is what you're saying?
Just a smidge. Just a smidge. So, but for anybody else who is here, of course, I want everybody to be safe, but a lot of people are staying off the road. The traffic into downtown LA is non-existent at the moment. So it has created some concern.
Well, I noticed, as you know, I'm bringing my daughter out there in a couple of weeks for some college tours. We're going to go to USC and UCLA, and there weren't any available tours at UCLA for the entire summer until about a week ago.
Oh, and wow.
And right after I texted you about it, and then a whole bunch of slots opened up. So our theory is that people aren't coming now because of the riots or the protests. And so I guess it also had that beneficial effect in terms of our availability of college tours. And I wonder how it's going to affect admissions or applications too. So anyway, wow. Looking forward to my trip out there, and hopefully it won't be too problematic.
No, it'll be great. It'll be great. And I can't wait to see you both.
So on that note, we're thrilled to invite Tara Eberle and Ken Suggs to the podcast today. They are trial lawyers at the firm Jeanette, Jeanette and Suggs, which has offices all over the South, but including Maryland and South Carolina, where Tara and Ken are located today. Welcome, guys.
Well, thank you. And it's actually Jeanette and Suggs. So.
Jeanette. Okay.
We get a lot of calls for people who want to speak to Jeanette Suggs.
Yeah. So there's two Jeanettes and only one Suggs.
Well, actually, there are two Jeanettes, yes. Father and son.
Yep. So tell us, I read both of your bios. You're both very impressive trial lawyers. Ken, I was interested to see that you were a member of the Navy and served our country in Vietnam before coming back and apparently starting a career as a trial lawyer. Given all that, do you have some thoughts on the current state of affairs before we move into the world of trial law?
How political do you want to get? I mean, I think our current state of affairs is outrageously miserable in terms of the leadership that we have in Washington, D.C., all through the various branches. One of my daughters is actually the chief executive officer of No Labels, who tried to run an alternative candidate, but never could find anybody that had a chance to win that wanted to take that on. And they've been working real hard for several years trying to get people to talk to each other across the aisle. But, you know, this environment, it's really a tough job. I don't envy her.
Yeah, no, that is tough. I recall what their efforts thought they might find a candidate to run, but never panned out.
But for me, I'm standing with Bruce Springsteen.
Me too. I love the boss.
Yeah, me too.
He's the best. Yeah, he should run. We may have aged out by now.
Yeah, well, he's almost as old as I am. He's 75. I'm 78. So
can you just give us a little bit of your backstory? How did you go from serving our country then to deciding to try cases?
Well, okay. So I grew up in a little mill village. My father left us when I was like 3 years old. We were evicted from the rental house we lived in. I mean, one of the first things I remember is standing in the front yard with my mother and my sister and our furniture in the yard. And she went off to secretarial school and got a good job, eventually worked for the Social Security Administration, eventually put my sister through nursing school and me through Clemson with no debt whatsoever. I mean, so she's, of course, not with us anymore, but I owe her probably everything that I am today. I went to Clemson. I did not do well at Clemson. I was not a good student whatsoever. But at the end of my 4 years, it was 1968, and I got a letter from the draft board saying, you know, they wanted me to serve my country. So I joined the Navy and spent 4 years there as an enlisted man. There were a lot of guys that had college degrees that were enlisted in the Navy at the time. Took the LSAT on board the ship and went to law school. The first lawyer I ever met in my life was my first law school professor for civil procedure. One of the things that had impressed me living in the mill village where I lived was, you know, the fathers there were all handymen. They got off the work from the mill at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they fixed cars, they could make furniture, they could do almost anything. But they would talk to us kids. And one of the things is they were all missing some piece of their, you know, finger or an eye or an ear or something because the mills were so dangerous then. And they would tell us kids, look, get your education because that's something no one can ever take away from you. It impressed me that these people who could do almost anything didn't have anything that they could call their own that wasn't at risk. you know, when I went to law school, I said, those are the people I want to help. And I started out in a practice where I, you know, we did almost everything, but I did an awful lot of workers' compensation, including brown lung disease, which was a big problem in the mills at the time, and actually ended up going to the South Carolina Supreme Court and getting some fairly good rulings on occupational diseases in favor of the workers. So that background propelled me into doing what I do.
Kind of like Ken, I have an unconventional path to being a plaintiff's lawyer or a lawyer altogether. I grew up with my paternal grandparents, where I lived until I was 16. I was actually kicked out and disowned because my high school boyfriend wasn't white. And that was supposed to teach me a lesson. And it did, but not really the lesson that was intended, if you will.
So, what lesson did it teach?
I'm resilient, actually, is the lesson that I learned. I graduated high school functionally homeless. I also learned that I'm not willing to compromise my own principle and values because other people's ideas were theirs, right? I'm not going to change me for other people. I was a young person to learn that lesson. And so I would like to give my family credit. They have changed. My family currently looks like the United Nations, and the grandparents that raised me prior to their passing, you know, got to meet their great-grandchildren who were all kinds of shades of love. So I think that's great. But anyway, I ended up in college. I went in Lock Haven University. I followed scholarships. That's how I went to college, right? I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. And I worked at a truck stop while other people were not. I'm winging it. Like, I didn't have any idea. When I was young, people said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I was going to be the first woman president of the United States. And I was so, like, I was sure of that. I'm going to be the first woman president of the United States.
There's still time.
Right? And people would be
like, we haven't had one yet, as far as I can tell.
And people would say, like, why are you going to do that? And it was truth to me, just as sure as I'm sitting here. And I would say, well, first I'm going to become a lawyer, and then I'm going to become president. And both were just as improbable from where I was. And I have become a lawyer. But as a lawyer, it really was because I was driven to help people like my family and the people where I grew up. I wanted people to have access to the law and bridge that gap. And I think that's what I do. I think that's what Ken does. We speak regular people. And we bring that here. But my path, I did like general practitioner work. I've worked in Washington, D.C. for the shadow senator of D.C. And then now I've been at Janet and Suggs for really not very long, 2.5 years. But I'll stay. I love it.
So in that path and sort of practicing in so many different areas of law, how did you land on being a trial lawyer, being your final destination, if it is? And I think
it definitely is.
Yeah.
I love it. You know, honestly, I think I was always a trial lawyer. I mean, and it's just, I've been practicing in different types of trials. And when I got hired at Janet and Suggs, they were looking for a trial lawyer, and they were like, we'll teach you the medicine. So I think that's where it's been. A sweet spot of I came with trial lawyer experience, and now I'm applying it in this sphere. It's been so unbelievably fulfilling to be able to impact our clients in such a meaningful way. I love going to work every day.
And you guys have worked together on cases, or tell us about that working relationship, Tara. I assume maybe you've learned a few things from Ken, his vast experience trying cases. What have you learned from working with Ken?
Everything. No, he like opens his mouth and like legal prose like falls out. It's such an amazing experience to be this far in my career, right? Because usually we're sitting at the table and we're the old lawyers, we're the mentors, right? But now I have Ken, and he just is generous with his time and his experience and knowledge. And I'm a sponge. I'll just soak it all up. Tell me all your stories. It's so great. I've learned from Ken that it's important to be me. He gives me space to be authentic and myself. He allows me space to learn from others and apply it in a way that only I can do. He takes my ideas and applies them in ways that are new and unique, but he also is so supportive of really all of this process. And I love working with him. It's just such a gift.
Ken, I mean, we have a lot of our listeners don't have the benefit of getting to work with you every day and have you as a mentor. What can you tell us some of the lessons, takeaways, philosophies you've learned and developed that you think are valuable to lawyers that are getting their start trying to go into a courtroom and try cases?
Well, you know, I'll tell you probably the most important lesson I learned from an experience I had when I had been practicing about 3 years. 3 years out of law school, one of my classmates and I got appointed to represent on post-conviction relief the first guy that was going to be executed after Furman versus Georgia. And the fact that they appointed two three-year lawyers lets you know that the powers that be really had this on the fast track. We didn't know what we were going to do. So we called Jerry Spence, and this was back in like 1978. Anyway, and Jerry flew in and helped us try that case. And what I learned from him was what Tara just said, you've got to be yourself. You can't model yourself after someone else. I figured I'll never be Jerry Spence. I'll never be Mark Lanier. I'll never be Tara Eberle, but I have to be the best Ken Suggs I can be. Then the other thing is you have to realize how much work it is being a trial lawyer. You can't just walk into the courtroom with a file and say, I'm going to cross-examine somebody. Now, I did some criminal work, which is you go in and you don't have depositions. You have to do these things cold, which is very good experience. But it's a matter of trying to learn every day. And to learn a lot of different things. So to learn the medicine in the field we're mostly practicing in now, to learn the engineering if you're doing product liability, and to learn the neuroscience, which is extremely important. How do people make decisions? How can you legitimately and fairly influence what people think by the way you sequence your information, by the way you prep your witnesses, by the way you present yourself in court, by the way you treat the opposing counsel, by the way you treat your staff, by the way you treat the court staff. And all of that comes down to being a good, honest human being who's willing, by the way, to take chances, expose yourself, and, you know, take risks. And that's the next thing. You've got to be a good trial lawyer, you've got to be willing to take a lot of risk, because people put money on the table. And I know you guys know this. And the clients start to get scared, and you know that they've not gotten to where they should be. They have the courage to go ahead and take that verdict.
So on the neuroscience, what new things have you learned about presentation or sequencing?
Well, one of the best resources, I think, is Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. If you haven't read that, you should, because it's really, I used to try to read his scientific papers, and they're a little difficult for me to understand, but in simple terms, he put into that book the basics of how people make decisions. And this stuff goes all the way back to Sigmund Freud's nephew, who was one of the first marketers. He made Listerine into a national product by making people think they had bad breath. And that's sort of an illegitimate use of the neuroscience, in my view, when you manipulate people. But there's all kinds of studies that show, for example, if you describe somebody and you put negative words first, people will have a negative impression of that person. If you put positive words first, they'll have a positive impression. Some of this seems pretty simple, but the truth is we've got these two systems of making decisions. System one is the one we make most of our decisions with. It's automatic, it's unconscious. And it's based on heuristics. I mean, what is familiar to us, what is presented first, what is presented in the most salient way. And then there's system two. If somebody asks you to multiply two long numbers, you have to think through it. And most folks in every decision in their life. They make a System 1 decision, and then they use a System 2 explanation to justify it. So if you give people right up front in your opening statement a System 1 reason to agree with your case, you vastly increase your chances of winning the case.
That's really well stated. Can you give us some examples of a system, how you might encapsulate a case? I know you guys are talking about medical cases, so they often have the underlying issues can be complicated. So you need a simple, salient way to describe that that allows for a System 1 type of response, right?
Yeah, so I like to start my opening statement with a question that I think is sort of the theme of the case and that people will agree with. And I'd like to do a question because then the juror gives the answer. And once you give an answer to something, you own that answer. And you're likely, by the way, to discard or delete or distort information that disagrees with the answer you've given yourself. So, for example, in a case where the issue was intermittent monitoring, where they, you know, in pregnancy, in labor and delivery, they put a monitor on the mother to monitor the baby's heart rate, which tells them if the baby is getting into danger. There are people who say that intermittent monitoring, where you put a Doppler on the mother for a minute every 15 minutes or every 30 minutes, is just as good. In this case, this doctor in a small rural town in Iowa had tried to use intermittent monitoring. And the question I think that I asked, it's been a long time since I tried this, was, wouldn't you want a doctor to have all the information that was available to make important decisions? And I think everybody in the jury would say yes to that. Now, we ended up getting an $18 million verdict in that case in a little town where, when I asked the in voir dire who on the jury knows someone else on the jury, every juror raised their hand. Okay? And then nobody in the courthouse could remember a time there'd been a civil case tried in that little town. But those people started out, I think, understanding that this doctor had not used what was available to her that would have saved this baby.
That seems like something, you know, the way you said it, Ken, is so perfect in that people own whatever answer they give and framing it right. But that always makes me think about depositions, too. And a lot of times people get impatient with a witness, a defendant. They go, I mean, they're clearly negligent. They're going to own it, right? Mm-hmm. But if you go straight up and ask them that question in question one after they state their name and they say, I didn't do anything wrong. Now you've made a, you know, potentially an hour long deposition into a 5 hour long deposition to get to the same conclusion. It's fascinating.
Well, you know, as far as I know, in almost 50 years, it'll be 50 years this November. I don't think I've ever had a Perry Mason moment where the defendant said, yeah, you know, I did it wrong. I'm sorry. Here's the money.
We just had a guy, the doctor actually fell asleep. And even then, he didn't know, they did not say. Actually, in that case, Ben, your podcast, your episode on a loss that where you use big data is the episode that helped us unlock that case in Minnesota, because I'm a trial nerd. So I listened to your podcast and then I got to, we ended up using a John Campbell big data study in that case. Anyway, so I wanted to thank you for sharing your loss, and it actually helped us secure a win.
I'm very happy to hear that. I'm glad something positive came out of that experience. I mean, that's why we're doing this, to try to keep the conversation real and to find ways to help people. So I'm glad that succeeded. Why don't you tell, can you tell us a little bit about that case? What happened with that one?
Well, that was it was a case we took over, Tara and I and Andrew Janet took over from a partner who had left the firm. And it was a case where the baby had a stroke. And I don't know, I mean, there may be other cases where people have successfully prosecuted an HIE case that led to a stroke, but I don't know about them if they did. Because there's so many different things that can cause a stroke. We had to sort of scramble at the last minute, and Tara and Andrew did a fantastic job. That was a case, by the way, where I said, okay, it's time for you guys to take over. And so I'm going to come to Minnesota with you. I'm going to be available to coach you as much as you want to be coached, but you guys are going to do it. So Andrew did the opening statement. Tara was prepared to do the closing. The defendants folded, right before the last couple of witnesses testified because they understood that the jury was not with them anymore. But it was, we did a big data. And I really love that stuff John Campbell's doing. It's been a game changer for me. And we managed to get a new witness added. Andrew did a real good job arguing that. And we had a fantastic hematologist from the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans who was able to explain to the jury how the HIE caused irritation, inflammation to the blood vessels, which caused clots, and clots caused stroke. So the jury was with us on that. But the real great thing about that for me was to see these young lawyers that are young to me take over and not be afraid and go in and do a fantastic job with everything they did. And I have to say that, throughout my career, I'm happy that, I can look around mostly South Carolina and see lawyers all over the place that are doing great things that came through my office when I used to have a partnership here in South Carolina. And a lot of them are women. And that really is gratifying to me because, again, I grew up with a single mother and I sort of have this affinity for helping to coach women lawyers and see them succeed.
Can confirm he's a big supporter and advocate, ally of women lawyers.
That's fantastic.
Like most things, women are probably better at lawyering than men are.
There's actually a study somewhere. I can't cite you the study now, but it says a mixed team of men and women gets bigger verdicts than just one or the other.
That's what I've seen, yeah. We try to structure our trial teams as having a man and a woman lawyer for that reason, when possible.
But you have to be willing to give them real responsibility. I mean, I was speaking to somebody and they said, well, we let our young lawyers do the life care planner. And I said, so you want to send the message to the jury? That's the least important thing in your case. it's actually the most.
He likes to say, he'll even, the defense lawyers often throw out a token woman lawyer. It's sort of offensive. Well, it is offensive as the woman in the room, but it's like the blonde sideline reporter on a football game. standing there right before halftime. And so she'll get up and she'll ask, they didn't even prepare her for how to actually take a witness in court. They couldn't even be bothered to mentor her to do that. This last case we had in court, the other side sent up their token female lawyer. And it was very confusing to those of us who were experienced in the room. The question she asked that she'd led, it was bad where she went. What was the question she said, Ken? Oh, we had a lovely family. She said something real terrible.
I don't remember, but
it was something like, so you're saying they didn't have their act together? And everybody in the room went, whoa, and leaned way back from this green lawyer. And we were all sitting around confused. And the judge looked and said, I want to ask any more questions. And I looked over at Ken, and Ken, his very sweet Southern accent, goes, you don't want to step in that performance. No, Your Honor. And it all just went on.
We had the recent trial. We had the token female defense lawyer who only did one witness out of about 35 witnesses. And when she put her witness on the stand, she called up a slide, a PowerPoint slide, but had mistakenly had her own tax return documents on the slide. So for about about 60 awkward seconds, her tax returns were on the big screen in front of the jury, and she was fumbling about trying to figure out how to remove it from the screen. It was quite amusing.
Defense lawyer in that Iowa case put up he was trying to run his own presentation from his side. He had a witness on the stand, one of my witnesses, and he punched a button on the pod, and you could see his outline, which included a big chapter, a big bullet point on the reptile.
Nice. So you guys were talking about taking risks, and we had someone on the podcast recently who helps to coach trial lawyers, and he coined the phrase that the stage is a safe place to be dangerous, the trial is a dangerous place to be safe, something like that. And basically his point was that I think trial lawyers play it safe too often, but it's actually dangerous in a courtroom to, if you're a plaintiff's lawyer, to play it too safe. You need to take some risks. So with that build up in mind, what kind of risks do you think are worth taking? What are some examples of risks that you've taken? How do you balance that? This is something I've struggled with. How do you balance the desire need to take risks with the desire to also be prudent and to make the best, the smartest decisions you can for your client?
Well, usually those decisions are whether to settle or go on to verdict. Although I'll give you a little story in a second about a different kind of risk. But, and so for me, it's if you get to the point where losing the money would be a tragedy for this, for a family that you're representing, that's when I start thinking they need to make a prudent decision. If you're going to give somebody life-changing money, or you're going to gamble with maybe a zero, then that may be a time to be safer. But I will tell you that as I look back over my career, I don't have many regrets about the cases I lost, because I tried them as hard as I could. I did the best I could, and I lost the case. I have regrets about the cases I settled, and looking back, I wish I'd let the jury decide. But I'll tell you a story about taking risk. I used to do product liability. I was doing a crashworthiness case, which, by the way, if you do crashworthiness cases, it's sort of like, if I get the urge again, I'm just going to go to the bathroom, take $100 bills and flush them down to the toilet till it goes away. But this crashworthiness case, it was a kid who was in a Honda, and he was turning into Bob Jones University, which is a religious school here in South Carolina, and somebody in one of those big old Lincoln cars that looks like a tank ran into and crushed and brought the B pillar down on his head and went into him with a quadriplegic. Defense lawyer in opening took a case of typing paper and put it on the floor and dropped another case of typing paper corner first on it, and it crushed it. And his point was, you can't defend against this with nothing we could have done to this car. So I went to a machine shop, and I had various gauges of steel box tops made that I could fit on top of the box, and I experimented until I found the one that didn't dent when you dropped a full box of paper on it. And my plan was to do that in closing argument, but I chickened out and I didn't do it, and we ended up losing that case. The jury came out, hugged my client, and said, "God's got a plan for you." I said, "Well, no, he had one, and you were it, right?" But but anyway, so I've got a phrase that I like to repeat to myself when I'm trying to make one of those decisions, which is, "Drop the box, go ahead and do it." And so that's sort of the way I try to handle it now.
Why did you not want to do that in closing?
I was just, even though I'd experimented with it, I had no control over whether it would crush the hell out of that box or not. And if it did, the case was over for sure. And I thought we were doing pretty well. I mean, we had a wonderful client, had a pretty good engineer witness, and I thought a decent case. And it was, actually in that case, we were trying it in Greenville, South Carolina. And in the middle of trial, what had happened is that Lincoln had hopped up over one of the median and hit the Honda at an angle. And there was a big question about what the angle was. So in the middle of the trial, in the middle of the night, we got the police to block off a block of the same block and found somebody that had one of those Lincoln Continentals and had them drive it back and forth over the median, filmed it, and convinced the judge the next day to let us put it into evidence. And it was so we did sort of take a chance there.
And then since that trial, have you ever, give us an example of a time you dropped the box?
Well, I think in the Iowa trial I was talking about, we went to mediation, and the clients, who were really nice people, had said, "Gosh, they asked for mediation, so don't you think they're going to settle the case?" And I said, "Well, I know they want to settle the case, but they're probably going to offer us $2 or $3 million. And the client said, "You mean I have to turn down $2 or $3 million? And I said, "Yes, you do." I mean, that was a time when $2 or $3 million wouldn't have done it, even though they would have taken it, they would have been happy with it. And we ended up turning down $2 or $3 million and ended up with that $18 million verdict. And, you know, I another crashworthiness case I took for a judge here in South Carolina, his daughter had been killed in a BMW fire. And in that, in closing argument, I hit a gas can with a sledgehammer in front of the jury to show that you could, you, this kind of thing would crush a fuel container. I didn't have any fuel in it. Of course, I had water in it that spewed out all over the courtroom. So judge in our case was not happy with me.
I couldn't imagine that he was.
I like the sledgehammer moment. That's good.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
Tara, I've noticed from your bio you've tried some nursing home cases with good results, some great verdicts. You want to tell us a little bit about some of those cases? Those are particularly difficult.
Well, my first slate of cases at this law firm was a slate of nursing home cases. And so my first personal injury trial as a personal injury lawyer was a nursing home case. Here in Maryland, I tried it with Reza Devani.
Oh, he was on our podcast at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so he was so excited. He was like, "Oh, I got a trial lawyer." I was like, "Yay!" And then I was like, "I've never done a nursing home case." He was like, "Oh!" So I had to read all this stuff, and I do. Like, I threw myself in. I learned everything I needed to know, and that was my first personal injury case. And so we were talking in a focus group, and I ask a lot of questions. I have a lot of different background than most people in our field, if you will. And I've worked a lot of different jobs. And so I remember talking with Reza afterwards, and I ask a lot of questions. And I was like, I understand that the turning and repositioning is what, you know, ultimately was the demise of our client. But what about these other things that they didn't do? All that money, they were just clicking or whatever at their shift to get through, to like leave at the end of their day. And Reza calls me the next. I'm like, I think if you put the records like transparencies in elementary school on top of each other, I'm gonna bet money that CNA did things all at the same time. And sure enough, that's what happened. And so from my perspective, that's what brought that nursing home case that blew it open, changed the entire theory of the case. And that was my first personal injury case. We went on to win the very highest verdict ever in the state of Maryland for a nursing home case. I mean, just Maryland, DC, Minnesota. I think that's it so far, right? We're in St. Louis now. I mean, I have cases now that are pending all over, but leaving the jurisdiction is relatively new for me. Yeah. I've mostly just been around Maryland and DC.
What do you guys experience in, or have you experienced in the different venues? What are the starkest contrasts?
Well, for example, in Oregon, you don't know who the experts are. No expert depositions. You don't even know who they are.
It's the wild west.
Yeah, which is kind of crazy, but kind of, you know, I kind of like that. And then, you know, I grew up in South Carolina where we had no voir dire, 12-person juries with unanimous verdicts. So it was really a breath of fresh air when I finally got to talk to a jury before I picked them. I think the first voir dire I did was in South Dakota when I came to work for, at the time, Janet Jenner and Suggs. And it was a revelation to be able to just actually talk to people. So that's been the biggest difference for me.
What about the jurors themselves? Do you feel like they're totally different from place to place, or are you starting to see that there's actually a lot more similarities?
There are differences. I mean, there are plenty of places, for example, where there is still misogyny and racism, and that, you know, I tried a case in Mississippi and for a black family against a white doctor, and I forgot something one day, and as we were leaving the courthouse, ran back into the courtroom, and the clerk of court was hugging the defendant. And, you know, and in closing, all the medical personnel were, the white people were on one side of the court, and almost every African-American person in the little town was on my side of the court. It was, but we didn't get a racially diverse jury because, in my view, back, the clerk cooked the books in terms of who came out of the box. Having said that, I think people, for the most part, are good people are good all over. It's just a matter of trying to find out of the people on that jury who are good. Now, I will tell you that since COVID, for some reason, it seems to me that jurors have gotten an awful lot more generous in serious cases. Here in South Carolina, which has been, took a long time before anybody ever got a $1 million verdict, now all the young lawyers on the listserv are reporting $1 million verdicts every week. So I think something changed since 2020. Now, the trucking industry is real concerned about it. You know, they've got a book out on nuclear verdicts.
I don't even think that it's necessarily nuclear verdicts. I think it's just math. Like, it feels like older lawyers are just not understanding, like, the numbers that they were used to getting earlier in their careers have grown with inflation and the cost of housing and everything else. It's math.
It does. I do feel like, Ben, we did start our podcast right after 2020. I'm not saying there's causation, but maybe correlation.
Well, there could be. I think there's causation. I was on my drive into the office today reflecting on, I mean, we've been doing the podcast now for 4.5 to 5 years. And in that time, we've had a pandemic, we've had fires, we've had riots, we've had political unrest. I mean, this has been quite a fraught period of time that we've been doing this. So where do you guys go from here? What's the next iteration of your trial practice? I mean, Ken, you talked about always learning, growing. I'm assuming that you're still learning new things now, implementing new technologies, new strategies, approaches with the Campbell. That's a new thing, relatively new. What's on the cutting edge? What are you guys seeing now? And what should other... What's up?
I know what he's going to say.
I'm going to say AI.
Yes, oh, Ken Stuggs on AI is my new favorite thing in the whole entire world.
Rahul and I are on a listserv where there's been a lot of AI talk going around. All right, let's do Stuggs on AI. What's the AI take?
Well, so my take is this. I've got a case here in South Carolina where the fellow went to the hospital with a TIA, and they kept him overnight and basically ignored him while he had a stroke, even though the CT showed that he had a blockage. And this hospital couldn't do a thrombectomy, which is an operation to remove the clot. Didn't transfer him. And then the next day when they tried it, he was already out of the window. I went into AI and asked about studies because what I'm worried about, one of the things is, and I know this is going to happen, they're going to come in and say, well, the damage was already done. There was nothing we could do. The thrombectomy wouldn't have helped. I'm sure I'll hear that. So I asked AI a question about that, and it told me about 4 studies. I went and looked up the studies to make sure they were legitimate studies, and sure enough, they were. 2 of them were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So then I loaded the studies back in and said to Gemini, make me a cross-examination for a defendant expert who is going to say that the thrombectomy wouldn't help. And it came back with pretty simplistic, and I said, no, I really want a sophisticated one using these studies. And it gave me a brilliant, I think, cross-examination matrix. I mean, I won't ask the questions verbatim that the AI gave me, but it saved me innumerable hours of working. I mean, I still have to understand the studies, know the studies, and be able to point out the minutiae if I need to in cross-examination when the guy tries to say that's not in there or whatever. But it was a great, great start. And I worry for paralegal personnel, and because people are using this to draft their interrogatories and their request to produce. And I've asked AI to do that, and, you know, it looks pretty good to me. you load the facts in. Now, the challenge, of course, is these open AIs, you can't put client identification material into them because they're anybody else could, or at least the proprietors of the software can see them.
What's Eberle on AI? That's good. That's a good take.
Well, I really crack up, though, because kind of when AI is like internal emails will be like, they'll be like, hey, have you thought about, does anybody have really good ideas about this trial thing? And Ken will be like, well, according to AI, blah, 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 blah. And then his reply will be, would you like me to illustrate that for you? Yes, Ken. I actually would.
Along the lines of what you were saying, Ken, I tried a case about a week ago. We have this pre-litigation panel process. We have to try all of our, in Maine, all the Med-Mal cases have to be tried to a 3-person panel, which is an incredibly frustrating and biased process because one of the panelists has to be a doctor in the same subspecialty as the doctor you're suing. So we're in a small state where you've got a doctor right down the road who's sitting on a case against their colleague. But in this particular case, I scrubbed the record of any personally identifying information, but put in all the lab values and the imaging impressions and the signs and symptoms into the AI and asked it, what did the standard of care require on this particular date? And what I can tell you is, it gave me an answer that took about 30 seconds. And had the doctor done that on that date, our client would still be alive today. And it's going to come to a point where, and this was a case where they sent somebody home who was septic. 39 hours later, she was in shock and then died. If the AI can already practice medicine better than the providers on the ground, and they're not taking the 30 seconds to do that, I mean, it seems like there'll come a point where you can stand up in front of a jury and say, look, I'm putting this data into ChatGPT, and it's telling me exactly what the right standard of care is. You don't have to listen to my expert. You don't have to listen to their expert. I mean, it's right here in black and white. So
that would be a fun presentation live in court.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about doing that at the panel, but I knew given that there was a doctor on it, they wouldn't probably take kindly to taking the human dimension out of it. But it's and in law too, we're gonna have that. I mean, I think the AI analysis of a potential Med-Mal case is already superior to what a mid-level associate produces for me in a day and a half worth of research. It can do it in 60 seconds. So it really is a powerful tool. We just got to figure out how to utilize it properly. But
so a couple of observations. One is, You got the issue of how do you authenticate it, because it's basically hearsay, seems to me. And so that's a challenge we're going to have to deal with if you want to use it that way, which I think would be really dramatic. But the other thing is one of my sons called me the other day, and he markets dental practices all over the Southeast, and they're heavily into AI in that arena. And he said, well, Dad, you don't have to worry about it. Being supplanted by AI because AI can't stand up and look a juror in the eye. And let's remember that. There's always going to be a human element to trial. And the human element maybe is going to be more important. I think a lot of times it is more important than the information itself.
I could type in, make me sound and look like Matthew McConaughey and then play that closing argument video.
Yeah, there you go.
I can tell you, Ken, that you can type into ChatGPT. There's a Jerry Spence bot where you can say, give me a deposition sounding like Jerry Spence, and it'll his voice.
And it says, well, Ken.
I noticed Don Keenan has developed
a witness with doodads on your shoe, which is what Jerry said to me one time.
What's Ravaputi on AI?
I was just going to mention Mike Kelly had this thing on trialschool.org. It's a free website that you can go to, and they did a 4-part video primer on AI. It's fascinating, and I've gotten through the first part as of yesterday. It just got released, and not just interrogatories. You can have it draft complaints, all sorts of things with a high level of detail. And just like Ken, what you said, you get a complaint and it's milk toast, and then you say, I really want it to be a whole lot more aggressive in the allegations, so it's very clear of all the wrongdoing the defendant did. You can have typos, whatever, and then all of a sudden it comes out much more aggressive, or preservation letters, and it'll draft preservation of evidence letters, and it's unbelievable.
I'll tell you my witchy tool, the how I use it the best. This is my favorite way to use it. That when I'm deposing experts in the day and age of Zoom, I usually have AI open and I have my Zoom window open. And when the expert whips out some science word bullshit, am I allowed to say bullshit on this?
Yeah.
That I've never heard of before that minute, I say very sweetly, how do you spell that? And I'm typing that into ChatGPT. And it's telling me exactly what that science word is in layman's terms. And then I'm asking it quick questions, real time. I used to have to pause in a deposition to go take a quick break to like research things. And now it gets rid of that moment. I'm doing it real time, live, pivoting live while the witness is there. It's brilliant and I love it.
Yeah, it's really a powerful, powerful tool. I mean, Ken, as you pointed out, the kind of bottleneck in the AI, which is good for our job security, is that you still need humans to go into a courtroom and to stand up and give closing arguments and so forth. You also need judges to rule on motions, which is a pet peeve of mine, because you file the motion and it takes 8 months for them to rule on it, whereas you could probably load in the briefs and the AI would rule on it in about 2 minutes. And most of the time do as good or better job on it than the judge might. Now, that's not going to come to pass because there's no confidence that that would be something that would be accepted by anybody. And I'm not trying to argue that it should be, but it is kind of an odd situation where we have these really powerful tools that are superimposed on a very arcane system that's highly inefficient. So we can develop all these efficiencies, but it's still requires processing through a very inefficient process. There'd probably be motions I would accept an AI ruling on just to get it done. I don't know about you guys, but I mean, that delays your case by a year to get to trial date because you can't get rulings on simple discovery or dispositive motions that are very clear that we're going to lose. You know, just there's a conversation of there somehow that could be streamlined, but. Well, guys, it's really great. Our hour flew by here, and we really appreciate your coming on and chatting with us today. This is a fascinating conversation. You two are really a formidable force.
Absolutely.
I don't want to be standing on the other side of a courtroom facing the two of you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.